When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. But first, here's my Glinkonomics report for the week. So I read in the New York Times this weekend, maybe you saw it, the Upshot report, which talked about the idea of a great reset. We've been talking about this over the last 6 months or so, but the idea behind this is that with the Great Recession, we saw a tremendous amount of deconstruction in so much of what's going on with our economic structures, right? We saw so many people leaving the working market. We've got the lowest rate of, and it's true, unemployment's at a really low rate right now, not the U6, but the official one. However, the share of working Americans is also super low. And this article in the New York Times really talks about what is this great reset we're seeing? And is there a new normal? This idea that what used to pass for normal just isn't going to pass for normal anymore, and we're breaking down economic structures and they're not going to come back. And if that's the case, what does that mean for us? And what does that mean for you and for your children and the jobs that they're going to get coming out of school and as they move through their economic life? Like, how is that going to change things? I think it's worth exploring this whole idea of a great reset, and I'm going to spend some time thinking about it and talking to people over the next few weeks. So keep tuning back to our Glinkonomics report here on the podcast for more information on it. All right, now I want to jump into, and this is another idea of new normal, right? CoreLogic's foreclosure notes. So we're going to talk about that next. So let's call it the new normal, or maybe the big reset. So when it comes to foreclosures, numbers are still continuing to drop. That's all good and reassuring for the housing market. But there are still more than twice the number of homeowners in serious delinquency, late paying on their mortgage, as there were before the recession. So is this the great reset? I'm Elise Glink. Here's today's Real Estate Minute. CoreLogic puts the number of completed foreclosures in March at about 41,000, and that's down from 48,000 the same time last year. It's a decline of more than 15%. It marks a decline of over 65% from the peak number we reached in September of 2010. Awesome. Here's the bad news. It's a 7% increase from February. Overall, since the homeownership rate reached its highest point in 2004, there have been 7.7 million completed foreclosures. 7.7 million. That is a whole lot of families that are not in their houses. To put it in perspective, the average number of completed foreclosures nationwide per month between 2000 and 2006 was around 21,000. In the last year, 110,000 foreclosures were completed in Florida alone. Now, foreclosure inventory in March dropped more than 25% year over year to a little over 500,000 homes nationwide. So the longer trend lines are still showing that foreclosures are moving in the right direction. The same goes for serious mortgage delinquency rate, which includes loans over 90 days past due, loans in foreclosure, and real estate owned loans, REOs. That number stood at 3.9% in March, and that's the lowest level since May of 2008. But and here's the big but, the average rate before the recession was just 1.5%, or half of where it is today. And that tells me things haven't returned anywhere near normal in the housing market yet. Okay, let's get on with the rest of today's show. I've got two guests with me this week, one of whom got the extended interview treatment, and I hope you enjoy that. But I'm starting off talking with Jonathan Miller. He's a good friend of mine. He's president and CEO of Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers and Consultants. We're going to talk about the astronomical prices he's seeing for property in Manhattan, as well as some nationwide trends in home values that I just discussed in my Glinkonomics report. He spends Friday night, well, I guess it's Thursday night for Friday morning, writing up all the information that he's getting in his week from just housing prices and appraisal statistics. He works at a very, very high level. And if you haven't signed up for his free weekly newsletter, you might want to do it as well. That's Jonathan Miller at Miller Samuel. And in the report, we talk about how to find him. Next, I've got Jeff Ball. He's CEO of private money lender Vizio Financial Services, and we're doing an extended interview because there's so much to discuss in Vizio's annual residential real estate investor survey. It's one of the few reports that I've seen that really breaks down trends among individual real estate investors in particular. So stay tuned to hear all kinds of statistics about who's investing in real estate these days, what their expectations are as a group for real estate investing in the year ahead, and what it all means for you. After that, I've got a detailed breakdown of the advantages and disadvantages of using an LLC to own real estate investments. And if you're considering making that move, you are absolutely going to want to hear that segment as well. On a final note, I really appreciate the feedback that we're starting to get on this podcast each week, and I hope you're also going and seeing the actual videos because I think they're really cool. And just so you know, we are working to bring up the production levels of this, so you might hear some changes as we go forward over the weeks. But feel free to send that feedback. We really, really appreciate it. And just a little plug, my Monday morning marketing podcast that I do with John Byrne on Fridays, where we rehash what's going right and what's going wrong with marketing and PR, another one of my great loves through my ThinkLink Media company. You can find that on iTunes as well, or go to thinklinkmedia.com and just look on the blog. Whew, I'm already exhausted. We haven't any done anything yet. All right, that's this week's lineup. Let's get started. See you online. So my good friend Jonathan Miller is back on the show with me today. He's president and CEO of Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers and Consultants, and I've known him for longer than I can even remember not knowing him, so that's a while. We last spoke in February, and at that time, he said that he didn't believe there was a national real estate market. We hear a lot of national numbers thrown around, but he doesn't see it as national. He sees it as a large assemblage of local real estate markets. And those markets vary wildly in valuations and pricing trend lines. So one of the places that happens to be the most insane at the moment is in Jonathan's back door. And so I invited him back to touch on some of these astronomically priced neighborhoods in New York City, of all places. And then I thought we'd talk about affordability issues facing homeowners and buyers, which is another issue that I know is near and dear to your heart, Jonathan. So welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Great to be with you, Elise.
So I looked at your numbers in your Friday newsletter, which, by the way, everybody who's watching this should sign up for Jonathan's Friday newsletter. It is packed with really interesting information. So kudos to you for doing that every week.
Thank you.
Brooklyn, median rental price, home sale prices in Manhattan, in Brooklyn. What is going on? Everything seems to just be hitting a new record high. It's a little bit like Picasso's that sell at auction.
Well, it's really been quite a show the last few years, both in the New York City market and then also some other high-priced housing markets around the country. You're seeing this phenomenon where rents are rising rapidly and sale prices are rising rapidly. So hence the affordability crisis that we're talking about it nationwide. In Brooklyn, for example, the median rent hit an all-time record. And it's been flirting with a record for most of the last 2 years. It just keeps either breaking through or just missing. And that's a real challenge to affordability. One of the big stories in New York is that we're seeing record employment growth. And we're also seeing the proliferation of tight credit conditions, which are making it harder for first-time buyers to enter the purchase market. So they're tipped back to renting, and rents it would be created a log jam and rents rise. And that's what we're seeing.
So we see that there are foreign lenders, or you've been seeing that foreign lenders are underwriting all seven of the largest luxury condo developments in construction right now in Manhattan, which is insane. We're seeing billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of condos in maybe a dozen buildings sell. Most of them are selling to people who are foreigners, and most of those people will spend maybe a week or two in those condos, which will be fully furnished. This is not a... It's driving all the other prices, or it seems to be driving them all up. But I just read in the New York Times last week that if you want to find a good deal, go look in the mid-50s in the Upper East or Upper West Side.
Right. I think in fairness to a high-priced housing market like New York, in many ways, I characterize this super luxury phenomenon. We just had a sale that closed 2 days before Christmas and became public knowledge a few months ago. They set the record in one of these new buildings of $100.5 million.
Wow.
And chances are, and that broke the old record of a few years ago of $88 million, but there's been a slew of new projects announced that are under construction or that are conversions of office buildings where you're seeing penthouse pricing somewhere in the neighborhood of anywhere from $115 million to $175 million.
I don't even know what to say about that. That's crazy numbers, right?
Well, not only that, but it isn't their primary residence. So This is a global phenomenon. And while in New York, you know, in certain locations, like in the Central Business District, Midtown, where all the big office towers are, that's where a lot of this is happening. That's heavily, or the majority, international consumers. The balance of the, and we're seeing, you know, lots of product in downtown Manhattan and other markets that is heavy on New Yorkers or U.S. citizens that are very wealthy. What I like to say is we're building the world's most expensive bank safety deposit boxes. In other words, you put your valuables in this box and you rarely visit. And that's the phenomenon that's happening on a global basis. Other markets that I cover, like Miami, Los Angeles, Aspen, Colorado, we're seeing the same phenomenon, as well as London, Hong Kong, et cetera, around the world. And there's a lot of forces driving it. And I don't see those forces changing over the next decade or so.
It's hard to even imagine. I mean, when I think about the Tiffany markets, right? I call them the Tiffany markets.
It's,
you know, these incredible markets of Hong Kong or Paris, London, Vancouver, right?
Vancouver, for sure, right?
It's been crazy. I was in Vancouver, I don't know, 18 months ago, and it looked nothing like the Vancouver of 25 years ago, the last time I had been there. And we're wandering the waterfront, and every single building is new and gleaming and beautiful, and there's, you know, cranes everywhere. And I looked at Sam, and I just went, "This is so unlike the U.S." And he said, "Yeah, I mean, where you haven't seen that kind of building since I want to say Chicago in 1990 is the last time you really saw 25 cranes in the air." And the only reason I know that is because I wrote a cover story about it for Chicago Magazine.
Right.
Where is all the building coming from? And now I feel like it's really being driven by these ultra-wealthy people who are looking to just plunk cash down into something. They pay cash. There are no mortgages for a $100 million apartment that I know of.
Right.
So they pay cash, and it just sits there, and they pay their monthly assessments. They have it beautifully furnished. And like you said, they don't use it. It's still in pristine condition when they go to sell. And then the next multi-gazillionaire goes in and rips out everything they've done and redoes it in their own taste.
Right. Well, actually, I think a lot of the purchases that are being made, it isn't about, you know, flipping. It isn't about a return on investment even. It really is about capital preservation. If you think about the global credit environment or economic environment, you have Europe on a sort of slippery slope with the euro, with the recession. You have China with the housing bubble and this massive extraction of wealth to diversify. You have South America, where you have countries like Brazil that had overheated economies that are starting to, you know, level off or cool off. It's very expensive for investors. The U.S., with all the insanity of sort of Washington and politics, we seem to be this global people's safe haven, and also this attraction towards hard assets like real estate seems to benefit. One of the challenges of new construction or looking at the housing market is that we tend now not to be building sort of middle-income type housing. We tend to be building, you know, it's skewed, whether it's single-family construction, Toll Brothers, or whether it's urban markets, we're skewed towards very high end of the market, and that makes it more expensive for everybody else, necessarily because we're selling $100 million units, but because inventory remains low throughout the U.S. for sort of middle-class type housing stock.
It's a great insight, and I really appreciate it. It's hard to believe that we have become a world where we're really focused on the top, say, 7 million families of the world who have a net worth in greater of $1 billion, right? It's just hard to believe that that's where the world has now come to. It's a 1,000th of 1% of the 7 billion people on this planet. It's just a completely crazy and, I think, unsustainable way for us to go forward with investment. But Jonathan, I know you and I have like a very like mind on this, and I'm sure we'll talk about this again soon.
Oh, anytime.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me. Jonathan Miller is president and CEO of Miller Samuel. He is one of the great appraisers, and every Friday he talks about all the stuff that he sees going on with lots of charts for all you wonky investors out there. So you can go to millersamuel.com. We will also put out the link for you and sign up. I encourage you to do it. I always learn a lot. I had a chance last month to meet Jeff Ball. He's the CEO of Vizio Financial Services, which is a private money lender that provides financing to real estate investors. As a private money lender, their interest rates are significantly higher than you'd find from a bank. However, their approval process is a lot easier and is based on more and different qualities relating to the property rather than the buyer. Not that they aren't interested in you as a borrower, but there's other things that go into it. I asked Jeff back with me today because Vizio just released its annual residential real estate investor report, which looks at trends from all the data they've compiled by surveying investors they've worked with since they got into the lending business in 2011. There is a ton of data in this report, so I asked Jeff if he's game to do a two-part interview, and this part will focus on who is actually investing in real estate, and then the second part I want to talk about what they think, based on the data, is going to happen later this year and into 2016 with investments. Hey, Jeff, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's good to have you. So let's describe the average investor that you've gotten to know through your work.
Yeah, so what our data says is right now the average investor is 52 years old. About two-thirds of them are married. About 75% of them are male. And their household income, the average household income, is about $120,000 a year. And for most of them, they generate about a third of their household income through real estate investing.
So these people are active investors, mostly male. They're already earning good income, but if it's $125,000, a good $30,000, $40,000 of that is coming from their residential investing. That's pretty interesting. Another statistic I thought was pretty interesting is that African American investors are comprising 22% of your investor class, which is significantly higher than the general population. Why is that?
I think some of that probably has to do with the markets that we're most active in. Our contact database is extensive, and it's focused heavily in the Midwest and the upper Midwest, down the eastern seaboard and into the Southeast. So I think some of this is the markets we're most active. And then I think also some of this has to do with the neighborhoods that are in the greatest need of redevelopment have a disproportionate share of minorities.
It's interesting. So of your population, I think you found one of the statistics that also jumped out at me is that 25% of investors make less than 10% of their total household income from investing, and just 4% earn all of it from investing. Do you see that number shifting at all since 2011?
There is some shift in that data, but I think one of the dominant trends in the market is that right now, real estate investing, a majority of the investors remain part-time, and there are some impediments to them expanding their small business of real estate investing. So for most real estate investors today, they have to they piece their incomes together from a variety of different sources. And real estate investing is one of them, and for some of them, quite a significant proportion of their income.
Do you feel that you started at 2011, which was by any stretch of the imagination, a terrible time for real estate in general, a great time if you had cash and you wanted to invest. Do you think that some of your numbers are skewed because they go over these last 4 years, which have been so unique in the life cycle of a real estate investment?
I would describe it this way. I think one of the trends that we're now seeing is availability of quality deals for investors is more limited than it was 3 years ago. There was a much greater opportunity to buy properties at very significant discounts to their intrinsic value. And so that meant that less experienced investors could get in with less risk. I think now in many markets, the recovery is at least probably in the seventh inning. And so a lot of those pricing discounts have been eliminated, and folks are having to become more creative in where to find their deals, and then also what they need to do to the properties to actually generate a reasonable return.
Are most of the people who buy from you, are they purchasing to use, you know, buy and hold, or are they more flip kinds of investors? What's the proportion that you're seeing?
Yeah, so we lend to both folks who are doing flipping or redevelopment, and as well as landlord finance, which are folks who are building rental portfolios. I would say our trend mirrors what we see in the market data, which is today flippers use private capital pretty extensively along with cash. Landlord investors, folks who are building rental portfolios, they still rely heavily on cash, but they are able to access bank capital more than your traditional flipper. But their bank capital is still quite limited.
It's interesting. If you had one big insight for investors to take away, what is it, do you think?
I think the major insight that we see in this market in the data, and obviously this sounds a bit self-serving, but a major impediment to investors expanding their business of real estate investing, whether that is redeveloping properties or building a rental portfolio, is availability of capital. On its surface, it appears that there's a lot of capital in the market. There's a lot of money been pumped into the system. But getting that to the investors in a way that is fast and simple that they can count on for purposes of making wise investment decisions, that is what jumps out in the data, is that's the missing link for most of these investors.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. Thank you so much. Will you stick around? We'll do talk a little bit more, and then we can give everybody another sense of what's coming, because I know for our viewers, getting an insight into the future is always very helpful.
Great. I look forward to it. Thank you.
All right. So yesterday, I was having a really interesting conversation with Jeff Ball, the CEO of private money lending firm Vizio Financial Services. And we were talking about Vizio's residential real estate investor report for 2015. And we covered a lot of information about the demographic of Vizio's client services, how old they are, who they are, how much they make, what they're doing. And you can watch that video from yesterday, which is up online as well. But today I wanted to talk about some of the survey findings about investor intentions going forward and where you might gain some insight from learning what Jeff and his numbers are telling us. Jeff, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. So tell me a little bit about what your investors are planning to do over the next 6, 12, 18 months.
Yeah, so what our data currently shows is that investor demand and interest remains very strong. Nearly 50% of the respondents for our annual survey indicated they plan to buy 4 more properties in 2015.
Wow.
So yes, that's pretty similar to what we've seen over the last couple of years. So demand remains strong. We also see that investors are continuing to express an interest in being able to pursue a hybrid strategy of being able to both flip properties as well as build a rental portfolio.
I would have thought that those are two really different skills, the idea of renting something out or fixing and flipping. And it's interesting that investors are trying to balance both. Is that a tax issue, do you think, or an income issue, or there's some opportunities that they just want to get fast money out of and move on and buy more?
I think, Elise, most investors see that there's a good opportunity to build wealth over time in owning real estate. And that then there's also an opportunity to generate short-term income through redeveloping and reselling properties. So I think having the flexibility to pursue both strategies is very important from an exit strategy, particularly as the market has become more competitive. It's not uncommon that an investor buys a property to flip it and then finds that they're going to go ahead and rent it based on what's changed in the marketplace in a relatively short period of time.
I heard from a listener to one of our shows, reached out to me in 2012. And at that time, Georgia resident, house was underwater and rental property was underwater. And so he thought he had a better chance of selling his personal residence. And then if he sold it and it was underwater, that he would then be able to have that tax write-off, or at least the taxes wouldn't come back to haunt him. So he, you know, reached out and said, what did I think? And I said, I think you should move into your rental, and I think you should rent out your primary residence, and I think you should wait for the whole thing to settle. Mm-hmm. So he reached out to me yesterday to say that, sure enough, he said, I thought you'd like to know how it all worked out. And of course, yeah. I always want to know how it's going to work out. And it turns out that over the last 3 years, the increase of net worth of both properties has gone up over $120,000. So now both properties are out of the red. They're back into the black in terms of equity and well into the black. He's got a renter who's paying him really good money that more than covers all the expenses. And that's gone up dramatically every year because he happens to be in a good school district, and then went out and bought yet another property using some of the profits that he was now generating. And so 3 years ago, this was an owner who was totally in the red, looking to do two short sales or go into foreclosure. And 3 years later, has $125,000 worth of equity and properties that are bringing in money and is living in his rental. Like, that's about as good as it gets, I think.
It's a great story. And the market is filled with lots of fun success stories. This business is really a great little window into the U.S. economy and how powerful the economy is in regenerating itself. And so it's fun to watch investors, you know, be successful.
Now, a couple of the numbers that I thought were super interesting about going forward, you're seeing a third of your investors searching for property outside their home states. And I know you said you're mostly kind of south and east. Where are they looking? There's not a lot of inventory out there. So where are they going to look for property?
Yeah, so in the Midwest and in the Southeast, everybody's looking at Florida and to some extent Georgia and Texas. Florida still, you know, is probably two-thirds of the way through its foreclosure crisis.
Yeah,
has to do with it's a judicial state. And
right.
So there's still a significant backlog of foreclosures in Florida. Those are the three states that I would say most people are looking if they're looking outside of their current state.
Interesting. And you also found that 20% of full-time investors, and that's such a tiny percentage of your, I think you said 4% of your pool are full-time investors. 100% of income comes from investment properties, but they need more high-quality employees and contractors to sustain their growth. Are they not finding the right people? Where do those people go?
Yeah, I think in some markets, there's clearly a shortage of qualified tradespeople to perform a number of these functions. And that's one of the challenges with the housing market. It has gone up and down, whether it's new construction or existing home sales. They've gone up and down so dramatically that you have people coming in and out of the workforce. But it does create some issues for investors to find qualified tradespeople that they can count on to do quality work.
Yeah, so many trades went out of the industry over the last 7, 8, 9 years. And as a country, we're not really investing in the kind of growth and rebuilding efforts that I think would keep these people trained and working and able to do other kinds of jobs on the side. So if you're not rebuilding bridges, roads, and schools, right, those are all the trades that you need to build and maintain full-time real estate investments, especially when you're building planned unit developments, right?
Yes.
So, Jeff, thank you. This is incredibly insightful. Do you have the study up on your website?
We do, Elise. It's available for download for free, and so we would invite folks to visit our website and download that, and we appreciate any feedback that we get from folks.
Sounds good. Jeff Ball is the CEO of Vizio Financial Services. Jeff, thanks for coming back, and we'd love to have you back again soon.
Thank you for having me, Elise. Have a wonderful day.
Hey, you too. I get so many questions from real estate investors about using limited liability companies or LLCs for their investments. So I thought I'd take some time today and tomorrow to give you a little bit of background on LLCs so that the next time you have to make this decision, you're a bit better prepared. So let me start at the top. An LLC is a distinct type of legal entity that is neither a partnership nor a corporation. Instead, it's a company structure that allows the owners to have limited liability, or, well, hopefully, if we do it right, in case the company has difficulties. So unlike a corporation, an LLC doesn't really have shareholders, but it has members. And unlike a partnership, where the partners may be equal or completely liable for the debt of the partnerships, but the profits and losses for income tax purposes flow directly to the partners, the LLC structure gives its members liability protection while also allowing profits and losses to flow to the members directly. The main benefit of an LLC is to protect the assets of the owners of real estate from potential liabilities arising from that property. So, for example, if somebody trips on your doorstep, right, and you have on your property and your property is in an LLC, the LLC and whatever assets are contained within there, that should be able to protect you personally from liability. They can sue you, but supposedly this will protect you. The LLC allows you to hold yourself out to the world as an owner of a property that is held by a company. And for owners of investment properties, it makes them feel better to say that they're the manager of an LLC or the owner of an LLC when dealing with their tenants, right? It gives you another perception of a layer. Now, LLC owned by single members also have the unique benefit that the IRS will disregard the LLC for income tax purposes. And that's a great benefit from an accounting perspective and helps to keep things a little bit more simple. But not that simple, because there's a lot of paperwork that comes with having an LLC, including filing the tax returns for the LLC, filing annual forms with the state in which the LLC is organized, paying annual state fees, keeping a separate bank account, checkbook, and all the rest, and basically keeping all the arrangements separate. And the reason for this, right, is if everything in the LLC isn't separate, then an attorney could pierce it. That's how it's known. So that's when an LLC may not serve its intended purposes. So imagine an accident, right? A good litigator will take the time to see if the owner of the LLC has handled the affairs properly. If not, the attorney can work to pierce the company veil, corporate veil, and attempt to go after the assets of the individual. So then you wouldn't be protected. It's really important to understand what the objectives are before transferring property to an LLC. If your only issue is your personal liability due to an accident that could occur at the property, you might just want to get yourself a more comprehensive insurance policy, right? Umbrella liability insurance that would cover not only the property, but would also cover other properties that you own and help defray expenses in case you get sued. You might also consider increasing the limits of your coverage on regular insurance policies that you're already holding. When you review all the benefits and costs, you can then make a better decision as to whether you can or want to transfer title from your name into the LLC. And be sure to think about this carefully, because you may do that, but your lender may not like it at all, and it could put your mortgage at risk for the property, and the lender may have the right to call the loan if you do that. So before you do anything, be sure to walk through the various ownership scenarios and what might happen one way or the other with your real estate attorney and your either accountant or tax preparer. Today, I want to talk about two secondary issues to keep in mind when considering an LLC for real estate. But these can vary by state. So you need to talk to your real estate attorney, right? Somebody who actually practices real estate law in your area for more information about your personal legal situation and how this might affect it. Okay, disclaimers aside, when it comes to owning residential property inside an LLC, you'll often find residential lenders will not lend to the LLC, but will require the property to be in your name, your personally, as an individual owner. Transferring title to and from one party to another can be very expensive and time-consuming. So keep that in mind. Second, when you purchase a property, you obtain a title insurance policy that covers you for any loss or damage you may sustain in case the property turns out to be claimed by somebody else. When you sell the property, that title insurance does not transfer to your buyer. So if you transfer property from your name to an LLC, it may be considered a sale and the LLC would not be protected under your former title insurance policy. So you would have to get a new one. If you as a seller transfer title using a quitclaim deed, the buyer gets title to the property, but no rights to sue the seller in case there are any title defects. However, if you transfer title using a warranty deed, the buyer, that is your LLC, right, has the right to sue you for title defects. And once you're sued, you can tender that defense to the title insurance company that insured you when you owned the property. It's a small distinction, but it gets around the issue of having to obtain a new title insurance property when you transfer title from your name to the LLC. And let me be really clear, in some cases, you might want to buy a new title insurance policy, okay? Under newer title insurance policies, certain transfers would continue to be covered under the original title insurance policy. One of those transfers might be a transfer into a living trust or from one family member to another. But generally, when you transfer property to an LLC, you're going to want the title insurance company to issue an endorsement to the original policy or to completely issue a new policy, even if you have to front the cost for that. Now, for some, it's going to be easy to decide, and they're going to go through the route of creating an LLC because they plan to invest in many properties and are planning to create a real estate empire. So good for you if that's you. For others who only plan on owning one or two properties, they might decide to hold title in their names, but make sure that they have great insurance overall. Whatever you do, please talk to your real estate attorney and accountant first so you really understand what the issues are and what your legal options and opportunities may be. I don't want you getting into trouble. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Elise Glink Show. And as always, I want to extend a big thank you to my guests. And online, you'll be able to find all the links and different kinds of things that you want. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. That's thinkglink.com. Also, if you're new to the show, please subscribe. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, please consider giving this show a rating or review in iTunes. And you can do that by searching for The Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. This helps the show get discovered by new people. This brings us to the end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Have a great week.